My name is Helen Jones, and you're listening to the BSE podcast.
Let's get straight into the interview, and I'd like to welcome Lambros Fatsis, lecturer in criminology at the University of Brighton and current holder of the BSE Blog of the Year Award with his article, Police and Black Culture, One Beat at a Time. I'd like to welcome him to the podcast. And Lambros, just before we start, I believe you're going to be judging this year's award. Are you looking forward to that?
Absolutely, yes. I can't wait.
Obviously, you won't be on your own. There'll be a few of us looking at the spread of blog articles that we've had during the course of this year. But I think it'll be a nice process to go through and always nice to recognise someone's hard work as well.
Indeed, so, looking forward to it.
Yeah. So to begin, I'd like just to get you to elaborate a little bit on your previous research, your thoughts on the importance for criminologists in particular, but also academics of any discipline, really, to speak truth to power and what that means exactly in the context of social media. I'm thinking particularly, obviously, in terms of your use of blogs, but also your use of music to highlight racism, state violence, and social justice.
Well, before I sort of jump into any of that, let me just thank you for inviting me to this podcast, as well as for hosting this conversation so generously.
You're very welcome.
It really is a pleasure and an honor, and actually a great opportunity to get together and discuss. Now, my previous research, I suppose, revolved around three main questions. The first of which was, what is public science? What is public life? And who is and can be a public intellectual? And my aim was always to really steer such questions in the direction of Black or Afro-diasporic music culture. And I did that in order to offer a different interpretation of what counts as thinking, who matters as an intellectual, and how to think about such questions through the medium of Black music. Now, this might not sound at all criminological or criminological per se, and wasn't in the beginning until I started raising the question of why is it that certain forms of public expression are normalized, legitimized, and canonized, while others are criminalized, policed, and ignored. So my work on the policing and the criminalization of UK grime and drill as public countercultures rather than as criminal subcultures emerges from that sort of very long, engagement with what counts as public life, ultimately. And obviously speaking truth to power speaks to such themes. And I guess when I think about it in terms of, or rather in relation to academia or criminology specifically, I must admit that this question leaves me a little bit divided between, a solidaristic mood which thinks of us as one, and a slightly more cautious disposition towards the politics of knowledge production itself. And I suppose my hesitation has to do with the recognition that we're not all committed to the same principles, values, or scholarly, civic, and political agendas. So I suppose when I think about that question of, speaking truth to power, I'm also thinking about whose truth are we speaking, to whom, and for what. So I very much see this as a battle between prohibitionist, reformist, and abolitionist versions of criminology. So each of those schools of thought has different conceptions of truth and a different relationship to power that I quite like to think about and highlight. Now, in terms of social media, it is very tempting to interpret them and approach them and indeed use them at the service of courageous truth telling, but I think we have to be very careful in our conception as well as in our practice of, I suppose, involving ourselves with social media. And I don't think we can think of them as neutral or idle tools that we can use whenever or however we like. And I rather would prefer that we approach them as powerful systems that partly dictate how much we can do with and through them. So although I'm very positive about some aspects of, I suppose, social media platforms, I also think we need to be very vigilant in our use and remind ourselves of the purpose behind our online activity, and to do that very honestly. So I think we really need to almost pose certain questions before we engage with social media, such as, you know, do we use them for self-promotion? Do we use them for building bonds of kinship, creating campaigns, sharing information? And how can we make sure that they don't use us as sources of distraction, which I think is rather important consideration to make. And actually, oddly enough, I've learned a lot about social media from Mark Carrigan, with whom I've recently finished a book called The Public and the Platforms.
I'll be interested in reading that.
Which explores exactly those kinds of themes. So I think it will be out later in spring by Bristol University Press. And I think what I really enjoyed through that writing process was exactly the dialogue that I've been having with Mark around such issues. So, you know, that book, whoever, you know, will ever read it, should kind of read as a conversation and dialogue. But I suppose, to return to your question, and rather provocatively, I would actually say that we need to adopt a criminal stance towards social media. And I use the term here by essentially quoting Stefano Harney and Fred Moten from the very influential book, The Undercommons. And part of my response is modeled after their encouragement to actually use academia and universities in a similar manner. So part of the argument that Harney and Moten make is that we should pretty much abuse the hospitality for our own purposes. And I think we should very much do the same with social media. We cannot, I think, approach them as a sort of neutral ground on which we stand in order to I suppose, voice our concerns, or speak truth to power, as you said. Now, as for music, obviously I'm very partial here, because it's literally the love of my life, but I also consider music to be a much better medium to help us think and act. So I often think about music as something that trains rather than drains our attention and attentiveness. I think it's very important in teaching us how to listen carefully in ways that mine our thoughts rather than just extract our attention. And I really do see it as a absolutely valuable resource for keeping us active and alert. And I very much see it as an undermined resource for scholarship and thinking. So part of the work that I do tries to very much celebrate music as a source and form of scholarship with and through through music. So really approach music as a valid yet undermined resource for the production of knowledge. So a lot of my work implies that that music could and should be used as a resource for knowing the world around us. And it often offers us a very unique lens through which to understand social problems. For example, I would have never written about the policing against UK sound system culture from the early Jamaican sound systems of the late 50s to UK grime and drill, had I not been a music enthusiast. So I think that's an important thing to note, that it is actually quite possible for people not to know any of that without being familiar with music. So in that sense, it actually offers an insight into, you know, problematic, discriminatory and unjust criminal justice policies, which would otherwise be inaccessible to those who might not be familiar with such genres.
That's a really good point to make, yeah. And of course, that continues a legacy, I suppose, of music and protest going hand in hand in this country, as well as elsewhere. I'm thinking back to the 1980s and the whole Red Wedge movement, you know, and the music that went along with the politics against Thatcherism then. But what I want to bring us to now is the current moment, this moment of COVID and pandemic that we're currently living through. And certainly public health has historically, frequently been a form of policing of Black communities. And responses to the coronavirus has brought together policing and public health like really never before. This union of policing and public health has led to more Black people being arrested, detained, and physically restrained in the name of public health protection. You know, and it doesn't take much to actually uncover the evidence for that. All you've got to do is, again, turn to social media for some examples. So as we continue to live within the context of the COVID pandemic, do you see state responses differentially affecting certain sections of our society?
I mean, I suppose the short answer is yes. But it requires a longer explanation. So, and that explanation needs to remind us that actually public health, very much like you said, public health is rarely practiced or legislated as distinct from public order. So it is actually more law and order than it is welfare and care. And we, of course, already know this, those of us who are either sociologists or criminologists or both. I mean, chapter 3 of Foucault's Discipline and Punish is a treatise on precisely that point. I mean, he talks about how the plague is met by order through surveillance, giving rise to disciplinary projects. So in just that combination of phrases, we get an idea of how the state responds to not just public health emergencies, but actually political crisis as well. And again, that's nothing new. And immediately, I suppose that the work of Stuart Hall and his colleagues through policing the crisis comes to mind, as of course does, Paul Gilroy's There Ain't No Black in the Union Jack, where he makes, similar points in one of the chapters of the book. I think it's probably the longest chapter of the book, called The Lesser Breeds Without the Law. So this is nothing new, but it's actually quite telling that the UK government's response to the onset of COVID was to police the public rather than protect people from the virus. And it's also interesting, as well as depressing, to notice, as we did, that the very first thing it did as lockdown was announced, was to actually create regulations that converted normal, within quotation marks, social behavior into antisocial behavior, and translate or transform fundamental rights and civil liberties, such as the freedom of movement and assembly, into criminal offenses. So it outlawed, I suppose, instances of public life first, without providing anything that could resemble, a policy to test, trace, isolate, and so on and so forth. So it's quite interesting that the first response to this crisis was one which essentially declared that, if you're outside the home, you're outside the law. And I think that that's quite an interesting thing for us to think about. To turn to who is more adversely affected by all this, right? The impact of such legislation, as it always does, hits the weakest harder. And, in a context of institutional racism and unequal social relations, this means that Black Britons are made more vulnerable to harm from the virus, but not because of the virus, but due to a pre-existing social ill. And that pre-existing condition is actually social inequality in the form of precarious employment, inadequate housing, healthcare provision, and discriminatory policing. So all those measures that are announced as ways to combat the pandemic actually marginalize and discriminate against communities of people who are already made vulnerable precisely because of state policy and state decisions. So this very much echoes, Ruth Wilson Gilmore's famous formulation of racism as creating the conditions for premature death. And I think that becomes really pertinent here to think about the impact of such emergency measures as actually mirroring, what the law, what legislation, and what state power looks like outside the context of such a pandemic. So I suppose this is, somewhat depressing. But I think the difference, however, in this particular moment is that in the aftermath of the most recent wave of Black Lives Matters protests, the effects of racism as an ideology, state practice, as well as the context in which social life is lived, have been exposed for all of us to see. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting that those two things, the impact of COVID as well as a reaction to police racism and indeed legacies of slavery and colonial rule, resonated to the present. And I think that was quite a unique and historical moment where essentially we saw calls to decolonize society, universities, curricula, alongside calls to defund the police. And it's interesting that all of that happened in the same breath and indeed under the banner of the Black Lives Matter protests. And again, at the risk of, I suppose, shameless self-promotion, I'm currently writing a book with the absolutely wonderful Milena Lam on precisely that issue. Called Policing the Pandemic, How Public Health Becomes Public Order, where essentially we really explore those issues head on from an abolitionist perspective.
Well, thanks for sharing that information, because otherwise how else would we know, actually, So I'm really glad that you put that bit of publicity out there. And in terms of researching this current moment, how difficult is it? Of course, we're met with example after example after example in a more sort of qualitative way. But do we have the data that we need to be able to research this further? Is that a problematic aspect of the place that we find ourselves in at the moment?
I mean, I think we definitely do have the data, quantitatively and qualitatively. In many ways, I think we actually already know too much. It's just, the problem in my mind is that the criminal justice system and other state institutions actually, go out of the way to downplay, deny, and refuse to confront such evidence and legislate in ways that actually exacerbate the problem. And so it's a useful reminder that actually these are not just unfortunate mishaps or irrelevant accidents or, transient deviations from the norm. They are the norm. So ignoring, denying, and downplaying the available evidence is part of how criminal justice and other policy is made, sadly. I mean, the introduction of the recent serious violence reduction orders is a case in point, where essentially what is being introduced is more an additional stop and search powers with less ground for suspicion, despite all evidence to the contrary. Actually, even the relevant literature, as in the Home Office literature that announces the consultation into such orders, acknowledges that there's precious little evidence to support them, but we're going ahead with them nevertheless. So, I mean, I think this is a striking example of, baseless and evidence-less policy, which, almost proudly acknowledges that, we're going to do this regardless of all the available evidence that there is there.
And certainly I think what we're seeing is this drive towards enacting not only guidance, but also legislation, with almost no fear of being challenged at all, either politically or, you know, by researchers or academically. And an example of this is this example from the Department of Education just last week, when they issued guidance for anti-capitalism to be categorised as an extreme political stance, and for books which are deemed to be anti-capitalist to be no longer part of the curriculum in England. But surely to be in conversation with young people about prejudice and injustice, racism, social democracy and justice is vital to critical pedagogy. And what do you make of that, Lombros? What can we make of that?
I mean, you know, you would have thought that these would be important things to discuss and reflect on. I mean, you know, that guidance is really as illiberal, dogmatic and anti-democratic as the political stances that it characterizes as extreme. And I don't say this lightly at all. I mean, we could go through all the points of that guidance bit by bit, and I could give you examples, you know, to illustrate that. But more generally, you know, it should suffice to say that it's telling that this appears, you know, in the aftermath of calls to decolonize curricula, or rather at a moment where such calls become mainstream. And at that precise moment, the government chooses to oppose and essentially silence freedom of thought, expression, critique and dissent. And also, it's actually not miles away from a recent White House memo, which described critical race theory as propaganda, or indeed Viktor Orban's ban on gender studies programs in Hungarian universities, right? Dismissing all that as ideology rather than science in a gesture that is actually pure ideology itself. Now, closer to home, this guidance that you just mentioned from the Department for Education and Skills, it makes it absolutely impossible to talk about or discuss the legacy of slavery, colonialism, or imperial or imperialist foreign policy, or indeed teach anything related to social divisions, social inequalities, or forms of state violence. I mean, my favorite bit in this, and I quote, is promoting divisive or victim narratives that are harmful to British society. Now, the phrasing here very, very clearly tells us that essentially the mention of such injustices is harmful. So, you know, that is the harm rather than the policies that create that harm and victimizes people by singling them out for cruel and unjust treatment. I mean, this is quite astonishing, quite extraordinary. And it gets even worse when we consider that actually the government conduct corresponds to the kinds of things that the guidance disapproves of. You know, it prorogued the parliament in the heyday of Brexit, which was unconstitutional and anti-democratic. It recently broke international law with its internal market bill. The COVID regulation, so all the COVID legislation essentially was passed by ministerial decree, not, you know, after parliamentary scrutiny. And, you know, the PM as well as Prime Minister, as well as the Home Secretary have both spoken rather derisively and with a certain amount of, you know, reckless arrogance, I would say, you know, about lefty criminologists, I guess that's us, and activist lawyers who oppose and expose punitive policies that they introduce.
Yes, they were depicted as radical lawyers, weren't they?
Exactly. So this is, I mean, this is just, it really is authoritarian stuff, and I choose, you know, my words advisedly, but I struggle to think how it is not. And if one really does look and read through that guidance, I think it's hard not to sustain that impression.
Mm-hmm. And very difficult to sustain conversations with our students when they're asking about these very subjects. And you know, so much of this actually does come out via social media. You know, we have ministers making judgments and decisions that are announced via Twitter rather than through Parliament. Certainly on the issue of social media, you know quite well, Lambros, that here at the BSE, we tend to limit our social media engagement to Twitter and very tightly constrained on that because our remit is all to do with education. But also because it's so time consuming, you know, engagement with social media is very, very time consuming. But one of the things that we've noticed is that, you know, many of the key issues of the day are met with humour, and I've got no problems with humour. I tend to laugh in the face of adversity most days. And sometimes humour is an important tool, a way in which to speak truth to power. But do you see there being a danger in perhaps trivialising and making light of these really important issues?
Well, yes and no. I mean, humour definitely can be extremely valuable as a safety valve and a comfort blanket, you know, which can offer relief, release and much needed consolation for sure. So it's definitely useful as a way of, you know, I suppose like you alluded, you know, a way of laughing to keep ourselves from crying or shouting all the time. But it shouldn't tame our feeling of anger and indignation, I think. I mean, much of what is so laughable is also very, very dangerous. So we ought to be really mindful of the damage that those who are the target of our satire do. And that is certainly no laughing matter. So it might be very easy to react with laughter to much of that, you know, clownish buffoonery that we see paraded around in our political culture at the moment. But it's also extremely dangerous because the consequences of that are truly harmful. So it's a very difficult one. Because we're being served essentially, you know, tragedy in the form of comedy and spectacle. But, you know, our reaction, I think, has to go beyond that initial, you know, cackle or chuckle, which of course, is almost irrepressible sometimes because a lot of what we hear is you know, beyond reason and very, very difficult to... you know, respect or react to in any other way. But I think we almost kind of need to combine that need for humor and satire with I suppose ways of thinking about how to react and how to confront such such realities at the same time.
Yeah, and there's something to be said for just pausing every now and again and taking a breath and thinking, okay, is this the best way to respond to this particular issue in this particular moment? Let me take us on to your perceptions of the future. You know, you've already spoken a tiny bit about the research that you're currently involved in and the publications that you've got in the pipeline. What do you see as on the horizon for the focus of criminological research? Big question.
Indeed. I mean, I don't know. I really hope to see, you know, more work on abolitionist criminological perspectives, particularly in the UK. And I'm really heartened to see some really brilliant work on sensory criminology coming up, which I think is absolutely great. So, I mean, it's difficult really to see ahead, but what I would say is that we certainly have a lot to think and write about as criminologists. So I'm very, very curious to see, you know, exactly what will emerge out of the ferment of such activity. And perhaps we, you know, we might, and I really hope that we do, that we you know, we might get inspired by our interactions with our students, who I think are more curious than ever to find out a lot of the things that sometimes actually have been sidelined, perhaps, in the curriculum, particularly in criminology and so on. So whilst I always never tire to for instance, offer you know, lectures on the colonial roots of contemporary policing, I think these become even more urgent now. So whereas before they might have been met with a combination of yawns and shock, I think now they've become really, really timely issues. And all of a sudden, you know, the legacy of, I suppose, colonial slavery becomes, you know, a present and an urgent matter for our students. So I really look forward to, you know, encouraging such a dialogue with them. And I think, you know, most of us are actually looking forward to doing just that, especially as the new academic term unfolds.
Absolutely, absolutely, very timely. Okay, well, I think we've pretty much come to the end of our time with this. So I'll just finish off by saying thank you so much for giving your time and speaking about these issues, which are, you know, of contemporary importance, have historical antecedents and will continue to be talked about in many different forums. Lambros, thank you very much.
Thank you, Helen. It's been a pleasure.
And for anybody listening out there, if you would like to contribute to the BSE podcasts or to the blog, which Lambros is going to be helping to judge, please get in touch. You know where we are on the website and you know how to contact us by email. So goodbye for now.